But some bad people are still out there, Gus. In the flames. Waiting.
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 358 for the week of June 7th, 2021. I am the miracle of duct tape, David T. Cole, and I'm here with meaningful slingshot, Sarah D. Bunting.
Plank.
Literary scammer, Tara Ariano.
Yes, I wrote The Velveteen Rabbit, as far as you know.
And flaming twig puppy, Santiago Melly Huber.
There's no crying in the apocalypse.
Welcome to Extra Hot Great for another week. Joining us for the very first time, a local TV reporter. Please welcome Santiago Melly Huber.
Santiago.
Hi. Yay! First time, long time.
We're thrilled to have you to talk about a show you hated. Spoiler. We're here to talk this week about Sweet Tooth on Netflix. The premise, it's based on a book by DC Comics. Sweet Tooth takes us somewhere really fun, the aftermath of a viral pandemic with apparently a nearly 100% death rate.
Yay! The content the world needed right now.
Right? We'll get into that. Coinciding with the viral outbreak, all human babies start being born animal hybrids. We see a puppy baby, a goat baby, an ape baby, some kind of bird baby. Couldn't tell if it was an eagle or an owl. Either way, no thank you.
There's a porcupine baby.
Oh, yeah, yeah. An armadillo baby. Correctly predicting that this world is not going to be friendly to his son, one dad packs up and heads with the baby to the woods, either inside or outside Yellowstone Park. I couldn't tell. We see a fence. Where he lives off the land pretty self-sufficiently and raises his deer baby, Gus. But Papa can't keep the outside world from intruding forever, and when Gus is 9, things drastically change. For the worse. All 8 episodes of the first season are now live on Netflix. We may discuss events from any of them. Be warned. Let's do the Chen check-in. Starting with Santiago, you've already tipped your hand on this one by tweeting, and I quote, "I can't think of a show I've hated as much as I hate Sweet Tooth, so I think I know what you're going to say." But go ahead. Should our listeners watch Sweet Tooth?
I'm here for this take. I'm looking forward to this. Okay.
I would like to amend my tweet because I thought of a show I hated worse, and that's The Big Bang Theory.
Okay.
But
Jesus.
I think this is too dark for children and too juvenile for adults. I have no idea who this show is for.
Okay. So that's a no.
So no.
Okay. Sarah.
Yes.
Okay. Dave.
First of all, for those checking out after the check-in challenge, for whatever reason, it's definitely inside Yellowstone because there's trees inside and nothing outside. So,
okay, sorry.
But I'm going to say yes if, and then we'll go into more.
Yeah, I'm yes if too. Yes if you have a kid who's like 8 to 12 or 13 maybe.
I was going to say if you got a tween, then perhaps.
Who's not too much of a scaredy cat.
Yeah.
Okay. We already started with Santiago's deep loathing of Sweet Tooth. Why are you so mad at Gus? Please go off. This is your time.
Well, when I saw the trailer, I thought, wow, this show looks very expensive. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if the writing will match that. And the answer was no. There was one line early on in the beginning that really soured the whole show for me. The narrator says, "Some stories start at the beginning. Ours begins here."
At the beginning.
Which led me down, my mind just started wandering to that scene in Girls 5 Eva where they're dissecting the logic of their own song. And it just devolves from there. A show should not make me spend 10 minutes wishing I were watching a better, different show. And it just never recovered for me. So the character motivations I felt were not driven by actual character development, but more so, this is what my archetypal character would do at this point in the plot, so mm-hmm. I'm going to do it. Like, I saw no real development in I don't know anyone's names. The adult... I watched all 8 episodes, and I don't know anyone's names.
Okay.
The adult who eventually takes Gus with him on his journey... Tommy, thank you. How many shows and movies have we seen where an adult reluctantly takes a precocious kid on a journey and then eventually grows fond of them? Yeah, that happened, but nothing made sense for why these characters were doing what they were doing. There was one point And, you know, this is getting into spoiler territory where Tommy is about to get executed by being eaten by a tiger. And Gus, the half deer kid, steps in between Tommy and the tiger and says, "Please don't eat my friend." And then the tiger doesn't.
Okay.
It just listens to the deer instead of eating the deer. What are we doing here? And then finally, the big bad of the season, his motivation makes no sense for why he's such a jackass to the scientist when both of them have the same motivation in wanting to create a cure for this virus. Because the scientist's wife has it, spoiler, whatever. He doesn't need to imprison the guy's wife to get him to make the cure.
Right.
He can just be nice to him and give him the resources he needs to make the cure. Like, the whole logic of the show just made no sense to me. I hated every second of it.
Let's go to Sarah, since she was a yes. I suspect possibly because of a lot of process content we saw in the pilot with regard to Papa setting up housekeeping in his apocalypse cabin to begin with.
Yeah, that's a lot of it. I should say, as we record this, 14 hours ago, the neural nanobot network was completed in my body.
Woo!
And I am now free to go and lick the world. And I will be seeing my parents tomorrow for the first time in 7 months and touching them for the first time in 15, which is like, and I'm a lucky person. So I'm pretty like volatile right now. Like, I planted some tomato seeds a few days ago. I saw overnight that they had sprouted this morning and I burst into tears. Like, that's where
Sarah.
I am emotionally. Or like the neighbors had a baby. I was like, they did it. And Dan's like, but you don't, but we, okay. Go lay down. So that's where I am. That's the channel in which I am receiving this.
Sure.
And I mean, this is like really dark virus content and like some of the sort of like PSA, like you don't have to keep wearing this mask anymore stuff in like later episodes was like, okay. Mm-hmm. But then I also was like, but because us. I also thought the opener was extremely effective. It was really good editing and montaging in terms of just being right on the edge of like showing you the world building, but not going into it too deeply. They also, like, I fully expected to hate this because there were going to be a gazillion losty flashbacks to like, this was me and your, you know, your lost mom that you're looking for in Colorado. Like, at least in the episodes that I've seen so far, which is not all of them, there's not a whole lot of that. Like, there is a lot of people wouldn't talk like this to each other at this point. In some scenes, but then in other scenes, there is a noticeable lack of that. Like, characters who would not be expositioning to each other because they don't have to often aren't, which in a project like this was quite refreshing. I think that the actor playing Tommy is making a lot of unexpected choices, given that it is, as Santiago said, a very cliched, like, hero's journey character archetype, like, set that you're dealing with. Like, it's like page 4 of Joseph Campbell, the story. So, like, I don't think that anyone is wrong to not be about this at all, but it was like between the timing and the fact that it was not doing things I don't like, I like it. I will finish watching it because I'm interested, and it does, like, it does look really expensive, and like there's a funicular. I mean, it's like they made it for me.
I did wonder, because we see Gus in a sweater and it's clear over the course of it that it's been adapted. He's turned it from a pull. Mm-hmm. His dad has turned it from a pullover to a cardigan. I wondered if you were sorry that we didn't actually see any knitting content, since I know you're also here for that.
I was a little bummed out that in the second episode, they didn't just like hack the pullover.
Right.
That they just found a zip up and it was like, OK, well, you know, That would have been an adaptive thing that I feel like Gus would have learned to do himself. But I don't know if we get more into getting stuck in your own clothes issues, which is not limited to deer babies, grown up,
well,
full humans.
Point, I'll throw that to Dave because that was something he was mad about as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I was I actually did posit the question well before they address it on the show. How does he put his shirts on? And then, of course, they had the scene in the cabin where he's having trouble putting a shirt on. So at least they addressed it. I was happy with that. My general reaction to this show is the same for most YA content, which is I'm usually into the concept. Like, I think Hunger Games, the idea they take people from all these areas and make them fight to the death, and it's sort of a sport, but it's also very political. It's like an interesting take. It's an interesting high concept. But like in the execution of it, I'm like, not for me. I feel like this is the same thing. Like the notion that somehow the apocalypse brings upon all the forest animal hybrids you could ever ask for, and we are sort of, you know, dealing with that outcaster metaphor is fine. I think it's a concept that has legs, but then the execution is, as you were saying, it's like, it's too young for me. It's too scary for most kids. So there's this very thin slice of the Venn diagram I think this show is truly for, though I think you could find things to like about it on either side of that, right? Mm-hmm. So yeah. It's one of those, I wish they executed it more to my taste, which probably would have been both darker, but also more comedic. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean like a goofy, dark comedy. I just mean like this show needed some more genuine sort of comedic elements to raise the base, and then also needed some, you know what I mean? They needed to compress the highs and lows a little bit. And, right. To speak in podcast post-production. But I wasn't mad at this show, but I also, like, I'm fine. We watched a handful of them, and I don't feel the need to necessarily go back and wrap it up. I'm Santiago, I'm really impressed that you watched all eight, frankly, given how angry you were.
Some people like to hate things with authority. I'm just saying. Mm-hmm.
I'm a television completionist. Like, I'm still watching Grey's Anatomy for some reason. And I almost dropped out of this show after a couple of episodes because I hated it that much. But I thought, if I'm going to trash this, I need to be fair and watch it all. Mm-hmm. So I just want to jump off of something Sarah said, that people aren't really expositioning at each other very much. I got to disagree with that. The scientist throughout the show expositions a lot about the same
thing.
Yeah,
in that part of the plot, it's bad. In the Gus big man part of the plot, it's markedly not bad. But then scenes with the scientist and anyone he knows, which is like, how do you even still know people? But yeah, I agree with you.
And to get specific about it, he reads about the treatment for this disease in a notebook and discovers that it involves like having to kill the hybrid kids to make the treatment. And you see he's shocked when he reads this in the notebook. And then he talks to his wife later about how he's morally conflicted. And then in the last episode, he is in a room with Gus and he's talking into his own tape recorder saying, I hate that I have to do this, but I'm doing it for my wife. Like, just beating us over the head with this so much, which I guess if it's for kids, you gotta beat them over the head with the moral conflict of it, but... And I just got to say about the last episode, you know, they spend the season on a couple of main hybrid kids and they do like a pretty good job at animating their facial features until the last episode when they have a group of hybrid kids and they just like hot glue fake fur onto these kids' faces.
Oh,
it's
no.
So bad.
Speaking about exposition, me and Tara have been we're just at the start of a CSI rewatch. And as bad as you think the exposition is in Sweet Tooth.
Oh, God.
Boy, the CSI, we actually created a name for it. It's called the Equal Idiots Theory, where you get two professionals who have been working a long time in forensic science and they explain to each other 101 things that are happening. Like, I understand you need to communicate to the audience what this blood work means. But when like Nick is talking to the lab guys, you know, blood is something that's inside all humans. And the other guy turns to him and says, blood is also red and comes out when you stab people. It's like that. They're both idiots somehow who are working these like very skilled jobs. I don't know if anything does it worse than CSI.
It's bad.
It's real bad.
The hybrids themselves, since Santiago brought it up, can we agree the bird baby was fucking horrifying? I saw that in one of the early scenes. I was like, this shit better not come back. I do not want to see that bird baby. Yeah. Sorry to be offensive to the bird community, but yikes.
Meanwhile, pig baby. Yes, please. Very cute.
See, even that I feel like is on the line of like what's acceptable. When I saw it for the first time, I was like, I don't know about this. I was like, puppy baby, where's the puppy baby? Bring that guy back.
I didn't mind the pig baby, but I was just thinking as a terrible parent, I would be very tempted to put like a grade A tattoo on it at some point.
No.
Yeah, an ape baby was like too close. I was not a fan of that one either.
Yeah.
Like too much like one of those reborn baby dolls.
And why only land animals?
Oh.
How is that filtering out? How come we don't have fish babies?
I was kind of waiting for a fish baby.
Shrimp baby.
Shrimp baby.
Good for dipping.
Can we also agree the internet permanently going down is absolutely what would cause society to crumble? Because when someone said that in the first episode, I was like, oh yeah, that scans.
Yep, absolutely.
I still don't understand why in the first scene, the dad has a television hooked up to like a car battery and then he buries it in Yosemite.
Yeah.
Yeah. Why bury it?
Symbolism. Yeah. Why not just smash it and use it as a container for something? Because he's going to need it in the future.
Yeah.
Like fill make an aquarium, grow some fish.
Yeah.
Grow some fish. That's right. Grow some
fill
fish.
Fill it with sea monkey babies.
Yeah. I think overall, I think this will have some of the same issues in terms of its reception that Amazon's Utopia did. We talked about that last year, that people like just may not be that interested in a fanciful / soft sci-fi take on a pandemic now or for the next several years, you know, like it's a little soon for me.
I think if you have a 9 to 12 year old that they may enjoy it. Like I think when I was that age, I would have been into this for the most part. Although even back then, I think I would have liked it a bit darker, but that's just me. I think if you have a normal, well-adjusted tween, that you could do worse than this show. It's not the worst thing, Sandhya.
No, it's the second worst thing.
Second worst
that's
thing.
That's right.
After Big Bang Theory.
Hey, it's time to go around the dial talking about what we've been watching on TV lately. First up, Tara.
This week I got a middle brow pick and a highbrow pick.
Ooh.
First.
Middle brow.
Okay.
We're expanding.
First, I've had middle brow picks before. First, I watched We Are Lady Parts on Peacock. For some reason, I got the impression this was a sketch show. It's not. It's a sitcom. It's made and set in London. Amina is about to complete her PhD in microbiology while also vetting potential Muslim husbands. It's impeding her search that she also volunteers at her community center teaching guitar to teens, since some of the stricter families consider her interest in music haram, even though she doesn't perform herself due to crippling stage fright. Elsewhere, Saira, Bisma, and Aisha are an all-female, all-Muslim punk band. They also have a female Muslim manager, Mumtaz. They're getting ready to enter a competition, but Saira thinks their sound is too thin and that they need a lead guitarist. Aisha disagrees, since the best punk bands are all three pieces, but she lets Saira hold auditions at the Halal Butcher where she works as a day job. And Amina, out for a walk, sees Asan, the hottest guy from her uni, with, quote, eyebrows you can hang on to. He really is super hot, by the way. I'm going to put a pic in the chat so that everyone can enjoy it. Anyway, so he's,
thank you for your service.
You're welcome. He's, handing out audition flyers cause he is Aisha's brother. And so Amina goes to the butcher looking for him and finds the band instead. And Saira remembers Amina from her very last disastrous guitar performance as a teen when she barfed on the front row. Sarah, they do not show it. But when everyone hears she still teaches, they figure she still plays and embark on a mission to convince her to join the band. So the show is created by Nita Manzoor, who is herself female and Muslim and has won awards in the UK for writing on comedy shows that I don't think have made it over here. One is called Enterprise. I can't think of another English language TV show that centered an entire cast of young female Muslim characters, never mind letting them be funny, which they are. The band members and Amina portray a whole range of ways to be in the Muslim community. Like, Amina's parents are supporting her and trying to arrange a marriage with someone she actually loves. They were arranged and maybe didn't love each other at first, but they love each other now. There's a scene where Amina's mother is, like, threading her upper lip and telling her, like, don't worry so much about finding someone that you like right away. You know, I just married some idiot and it turned out fine and her dad is in the room. So she's like, no offense, not taken. Sayira has been casually dating a guy. Amina, Aisha, and Bisma all cover their hair. Sayira doesn't. And Mumtaz is fully covered, including her face, although we frequently see her exhaling smoke through her veil. She's also got a studded bracelet, which is awesome. So I've only watched the first two episodes so far. I've only heard two songs, Honor Killing and Bashir with a Good Beard, but they both slapped. And from the dialogue, we learn another one of their songs is Camel Toe, which I hope we get to hear eventually.
Amazing.
Amina gets a few fantasy cutaways, and those are also fun. So it doesn't have the edge of Peacock's other girl group show, Girls 5 Eva, but it's fun, has a huge amount of story potential, and all six episodes of the first season are up now. You should check them out. I'm going to keep watching that one. Then, for my highbrow pick, Pose, which just wrapped up its third and final season. I can't really say it was a short season, although it was less episodes than other ones, because the last two were well over an hour long. Like, I don't know why you become Ryan Murphy if not to exercise the privilege of cramming 13 episodes of material into a 7-episode bag, which he did. I know he's not the showrunner, that's Stephen Knauss, but, you know, he's the one who had the juice to tell FX, this is what we're doing, and have it done. So the final season starts in the mid-90s, takes us up to 1998 in the series finale. As we begin, AIDS is still ravaging the queer community in New York, and the characters that we know have different responses. Blanca has decided to train as a nurse, Pray Tell is drinking too much, Lulu's pretty seriously smoking crack, Angel dabbles, but it's pretty clear the producers wanted to maneuver as many characters as possible to endings as happy as possible, which I assume is why Elektra suddenly is in the mob, kind of, midway through the season, and suddenly, like, super wealthy, so that she can announce she's giving Angel and Poppy an extremely extravagant wedding and include all the women from the balls by giving them each a gown of their own to wear to the event. It's a sweet idea, calling Angel the pathfinder of their community of trans women for having gotten to an actual marriage with a cis man is nice, I guess. And all the screen time devoted to the wedding planning feels a bit like fan service, but I also understand the show is not for me. It's for queer people of color. So I also know the show's purpose is to represent joy in queer and trans life, which we don't see as often on TV as tragedy and pain and drama. Is it kind of extra to have Poppy sing the chorus of I Swear as his wedding vows 3 times with the whole wedding congregation? Kind of. But if this is the only sandbox you have, it's not up to me to tell you what kind of games you want to play in it. So there are other dramatic choices like that. Moments where the action just grinds to a halt for a big set piece that I found a little self-indulgent, but the series finale had 2 scenes of balls, and I fucking sobbed at both of them, so it worked on me a lot. I will miss Pose. I felt it definitely had more stories to tell, and it's a bummer that it's not going to get to tell them. For my plug, speaking of telling stories, bad segue, I'm going to plug Listen to Sassy. We are on to the August 1988 issue this week. It's a banger. So you can hear me and Dave and our friend Pam Ribbon, who has been on the Patreon episodes before, talk about Sassy Magazine in a lot of detail. And also, for some reason, Miracle Whip keeps coming up as well.
No, Dennis.
All right, San Diego, what do you got?
I just saw the screeners for the first 4 episodes of Kevin Can Fuck Himself. And I really liked it. It wasn't perfect, but I really hate the trope of the schlubby husband, abused hot wife sitcom. So I was really interested in seeing a show examine what realistically would the woman in that situation be going through? What would she be feeling? What would she be motivated by? And, you know, Annie Murphy, love Schitt's Creek. She's amazing. And I'm really excited to see how the rest of the season goes.
I also watched those screeners. I'll be writing my review for Primetimer later today. And what struck me the most is how they switch from the scenes of her in the sitcom are shot on video as a multicam. And then when we see her real off screen life, it's, single cam. And the way she has to sort of be the same as Allison in both of those, be abused in the video scenes as well as act in a way that is right for the scene, whatever is happening, is really extraordinary. I have some other issues with the show, but overall it's definitely worth checking out, I think.
Yeah, I thought episode 4 focused way too much on Kevin himself.
Mm-hmm.
Annie Murphy's character wasn't even in those scenes, which felt like the show was taking a different turn there. But overall, I liked it. And I'm glad to be complimenting a show.
That premieres on AMC Plus on the 13th and then on regular AMC on the 20th. So if you're a subscriber, you get to see that a week early.
And my plug is for local TV news. Hear me out. Local TV news is often the butt of late night jokes. But if you're a listener of Extra Hot Great, I'm guessing you are probably pretty engaged in what's going on, generally speaking. But cable TV news can be anxiety inducing. So I strongly recommend, if you want to keep up with the news, watch your local TV stations. They do cover the big national stories, but they contextualize it, let you know how that's relevant to your own community. And also they talk about what is the school system doing for COVID? Are they updating the HVAC systems? How is your city council spending your tax money? Which roads are getting paved? How are your local elected officials voting on various pieces of legislation? Your local TV news is going to give you information that is much more relevant to your everyday life than cable news. And I'm not just saying this as a local TV reporter. I wholeheartedly believe this. And also understand that not all local TV stations are the same. And your brand loyalty doesn't really matter because your local NBC station probably is not owned by NBC. And within a specific station, not all reporters are going to give you the same quality of work. So give all your local stations a fair shot. Give all your local reporters a fair shot. Get an understanding of who talks about which stories, which reporting you like. Follow them on social media. Watch their stuff. And then just, stay engaged. And if you want to keep up with news that is happening in Central Virginia, or you want to see my reports about Black maternal mortality or white supremacist groups or all that fun stuff out of Virginia, or my takes on drag queens and character actresses, you can follow me on Twitter. I am at Santiago Reports. That's Santiago like the city, reports like the verb.
Have we ever had a slicker plug than that one?
That was gorgeous.
There's another another thing for the local reporters. They know how to talk.
We are very overworked and underpaid, and we're just members of your community trying to inform you of what's going on in the place that you live.
One favor. Can you just say now back to you, Dave?
Now back to you, Dave.
Sarah D. Bundick.
Over to you, Sarah D. Bunting, I think you meant.
Right, over to you, Sarah D. Bunting, back in the studio, back in our Brooklyn studio.
I mentioned Mike Tyson, The Knockout, as something that I would be watching a couple episodes ago on our summer preview, and I have watched it. It is now available on Hulu. It is diverting. It can feel at times like an attempt on ABC's part to repackage / showcase all of this proprietary footage that they have of Tyson's fights, news stories about Tyson, interviews with Tyson, before other projects can hit the market, particularly that sonic boom of a segment with Robin Givens on 2020 from back in the day. The project can also feel right down to the moody horn interstitial music and the flavorful insights of one Carl E. Douglas. This is not a problem for me, I'm just saying. Like OJ Made in America 2, Mike Tyson Made in Brownsville was the object of this for producers, or an attempt at a project of that scope. A couple of times it almost gets there, but there just isn't enough runtime for The Knockout to get its arms around everything that Tyson is and was. And 30 for 30, which is in the ESPN ABC sphere, already has like three documentaries just about various narrower slices of Tyson's influence on boxing and the culture, including, and I recommend all of these, One Night in Vegas about Tyson and Tupac Shakur's friendship and Tupac's murder, 42 to 1 about the Buster Douglas upset, Chasing Tyson, which is about Evander Holyfield's pursuit of the infamous champ and his title. So there is a lot of material here. Any number of narrower angles could carve off enough for 120 minutes of documentary feature. The rape and that trial alone is a limited series. So, I mean, this is for what it is and when it is, good. It's entertaining. It's not boring. I do recommend it. I don't quite understand what Rosie Perez's function is as a commentator. And as much as I like her, I think there is some rationalizing going on from her in Ray, some of Tyson's violent interpersonal behavior that is not a great take. Like, she seems sort of starstruck. Like, she's talking about his charisma and I'm like, but assault? Like, we didn't want to cut this? Okay. But for a project that probably was only hoping to distinguish itself as first to market, it's pretty good. Once again, it's called Mike Tyson, The Knockout. It is on Hulu or on demand if you still have cable. For my plug, there is, it may surprise some of you to learn, a lot of overlap between boxing and true crime. Good thing you were sitting down. That probably went without saying, but if you would like to read more on the subject or any other true crime subject, please head to my bookshop, which is only true crime, new and used. It's called Exhibit B, and you can find it at exhibitbbooks.com. If you don't see what you like, search services are free, and my pleasure to perform for this or any other true crime tome. Over to you, Dave.
Thank you, Sarah. We watched The Boy in the Plastic Bubble for EHG supporter perk test with a handful of people, you know, all watched it at the same time from our various places across the country. I just want to quickly say I had low expectations for this going in, but this is a must watch TV movie if you haven't seen it, and certainly something to watch with your peers. It is so dumb and bad and poorly constructed, and John Travolta is acting. First of all, I just want to say there's no bubble. It's like the boy in the plastic cubes at best. Like, if you imagine a boy that lives in a very large version of what you buy fitted sheets in, you know, those kind of crunchy plastic things.
That's exactly it. Including the zipper.
Including.
Oh, I was thinking Bubble Boy this whole time.
It's the same story of a kid that had immunity problems also inspired Bubble Boy, apparently.
This is 1976.
Yes.
With John Travolta as Bubble Boy and his girlfriend with the kind of girlfriend with the grayest, beigest teeth this side of George Washington. It is amazing how, like, nowadays, would somebody with teeth that color get within 100 feet of a camera on a TV show?
No.
If they weren't playing, you know, the love, the pride type of character? No, they wouldn't. All that to if you're the kind of person that really likes a deep cut Halloween costume, boy, this one provides it. The end, spoiler, I'll wait a second in case you do want to watch it. At the end of the movie, this TV movie, the boy in the bubble graduates from high school, which is quite the undertaking for a guy that can't even like get breathed on. And he has this sort of Russian cosmonaut spacesuit in sort of dark
made
orange.
Made out of quilted robes from the Vermont company.
Yeah, it's quilted. It sort of looks like a University of Texas kind of burnt sienna.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Burnt orange, rather. And then on top of that, he has a big blue mortarboard. And like kind of a cape or something that he's sort of draping around him.
Yeah.
And that's the end of the movie. And it is the best idea for a Halloween costume I've seen in a while. I'm not the kind of person that cares enough to dress up for Halloween. But if I was, top of the list, guys. Top of the list. So seek that out. It's on YouTube. It's on Amazon Prime.
We'll link it in the show notes.
Yeah, we'll put it in the show notes. Definitely worthy of a watch. All right. Mm. On the next Extra, Extra Hot Great, speaking about patron perks, we have Spin Cycle. Last time we had spinoffs featuring children of a TV show. This time it is creating a spinoff of a spinoff. And maybe, just maybe, it'll get a little weirder than that. So that is available to all our supporters at patreon.com/extrahotgrade. Thank you very much for your continued support. It makes a world of difference to us. Then, right here on EHG Prime next week, it is Vanity Fair's Richard Lawson coming back for Loki, a little show you may have heard of.
Today's extra credit topic comes to us from Guy is Delightful. The topic is like Studio 60, but entertaining. Guy writes, I was, by the way, held this for when Santiago was coming on because it's about news.
Thank you.
In my house, we watch a lot of The Weather Channel. Two of the anchors were once married, and now they very rarely appear on the same hour. But when they do, we are glued to the TV to look for any drama bubbling underneath. Guy, you are our people. There never is because professionalism, but we still can't help making up stories. This on-camera, off-camera theme is common in a lot of TV shows. So we are challenged to pick a real current TV news show with anchors, correspondents, panelists, etc., and create the show you hope is happening backstage when the director's calls cut. It can be a comedy like Great News, it can be a drama like The Morning Show, but you have to use the real people as the characters. So Santiago, since I saved this especially for you, please start us off.
Okay. My show revolves around CNN. Not one particular show on CNN, but the general primetime lineup crew.
Sure.
It's kind of in the vein of Veep, in that while it's joke dense, it's not really a comedy because you realize how depressingly believable it is. The show centers around Dana Bash and Abby Phillip as they deal with all of the men around them, and they occasionally mock their incompetence to each other. Every episode has a B or a C plot that probably features Chris Cuomo breaking journalistic ethics. Maybe one day he's wearing a MAGA hat on TV. Another day he's caught sleeping with sources. Another day he's running his brother's reelection campaign. Just really flagrant things that he annoyingly never gets punished for. And a running gag is that he's constantly doing bicep curls, just all the time. In meetings, bicep curls. Uh-huh. Jake Tapper makes every single conversation about himself. A breaking news event about a hurricane in Florida suddenly becomes about him having to cancel his book tour stop in Miami. A story about a baker denying service to a gay couple becomes about that one time that Jake went to a gay college roommate's wedding. Interstitials in this show will feature people like congressional correspondent Manu Raju catching up with lawmakers on the Hill who drop depressingly real quotes, like how Congressman Andrew Clyde recently compared the insurrection to a, quote, normal tourist visit. Yes, that is real. The show gets a bit absurd at times. A running theme throughout the series is that Soledad O'Brien, who used to anchor for CNN, commissioned a Russian troll farm to cyberbully Jeff Zucker. Meanwhile, Anderson Cooper is not allowed on the show because we have not forgotten what he did to Kathy Griffin.
Oh, shit.
Wow.
Nice. Okay, I'll go next. On camera, they are pleasant co-hosts and still newlyweds, having been married less than 3 years. He may have formerly been a Republican congressman, and she may have been raised by a foreign policy advisor from several Democratic administrations, but their political disagreements seem to have been sanded over by love, and all we get on the air is light banter. Then the cameras turn off, and Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski hate each other. They're constantly sniping at each other, making their producers' lives hell, and staying together only for the show and their brand. Co-host Willie Geist has taken to starting broadcasts by Irishing up his coffee. It's a mess in the new Peacock sitcom, Cold Brew, inspired, of course, by Morning Joe.
I love it.
Cold Brew. That's pretty good.
Thank you. Sarah.
It's very good. I consider doing a whole bit with The Crest, Ryan Seacrest, the busiest man in Hollywood, TM. And the first episode is an 18 years earlier flashback to a crossroads in Georgia, where Seacrest is from. And the devil, played by Daniel Baldwin, being like, we'll get rid of Dunkelman and give you more work than you could ever ask for, but it's going to come at a price. And before he can even get the word price out, Seacrest is like, I don't care, I'll pay it. Devil smirk. Smash cut to a montage of Sissany leaving prep sheets in the town car, getting morning sick on air while Seacrest cringes, saying stuff like, I'm such a super fan of Blues Travelers, while Seacrest cringes. Seacrest being like, I swear I had more Emmys than this, and then a long Inception-style shot, complete with brom, of two of them half-submerged in a sandbox in Calabasas. Cut back to Seacrest. Baldwin! Cut to Daniel Baldwin with cucumber slices on his eyes. Told ya. Okay, maybe this is actually mine. It's called Deep Blue Seacrest, and it's basically Barry, but he's not a hitman, and literally all the other parts are played by lesser Baldwins. But if that weren't mine, it would be something with Dateline called K-Roll or Vertical Holt. But the only things I really could come up with for that one were A, that Lester Holt is, behind the scenes, this super frustrated polymath who is trying to complete a combined PhD in organic chemistry and the Roman novel, which gives the writers room for many golden ass slash vomitorium references, like for a good season and a half. And he keeps wanting to quit, but his research grants keep getting turned down. So in order to finance his work himself, et cetera, and so on. And B, that Keith Morrison will not even dignify with a response. Not only open-ended non-yes or no questions, but any question that he can't answer with his trademark, yes. So he's in the makeup chair with like half a face on, and the PA has to be like, so, Mr. Morrison, are you not quite ready to go to set? Is that correct? Yes. Were you not given the updated pages? Yes. But I mean, there's not a lot there. You just heard all of it. Nice. Deep Blue Seacrest, Dave.
First of all, give it up for Guy is Delightful's confidence in naming his Twitter handle that.
He is delightful based on this question.
So far as proven out. Yeah. Mine is about the rivalry of the ever-changing lineups of the long-running Extra and Entertainment Tonight shows, which have evolved over the years. Like, these shows have had at least 36 hosts apiece throughout the years. So why is that? Well, this show will let you know why that is. After each show wraps up for the night, one show sends an anchor, a correspondent, out into the Los Angeles night to be hunted by the cast of the other show. In the most dangerous game style TV event, Quibi or elsewhere. Mm-hmm. When they are caught, they are killed and eaten to gain their courage and talent. This is why you haven't heard from Mary Hart in years.
Yeah, Quibi would work. I don't think that would take more than 8 minutes.
Woo, it's time for the evil goateed cousin of the canon. It is the No Knack. A terrible episode of an otherwise good show is what we are aiming for. Santiago, what do you got for us?
RuPaul's Drag Race already earned a spot in the canon for season 5 Snatch Game, and rightfully so, in my opinion. In choosing a no-knack, I almost went with the iconically bad season 7 Shakespeare episode, but even that has reached a so-bad-it's-good status. Instead, I'm going with an episode of Drag Race that broke the cardinal rules of television. It is boring and confusing. I see three main components that make up a great Drag Race episode. The overall story, the main challenge slash runway, which they're graded on, and the lip sync. In this essay, I will explain why in one episode, all three fail miserably, earning RuPaul's Drag Race Season 12, Episode 3, World's Worst, a spot in the no-knack. First, the episode's storyline makes no sense, but to understand why, we need a little bit of context. In March 2020, allegations came out that contestant Sherry Pie had catfished several men by pretending to be a casting agent and tricking them into taking steroids and sending videos of themselves performing sex acts. This came out the week that she first appeared in episode 2. It was too late to do anything with that episode, so we get a lot of Sherry Pie confessionals and screen time. She ended up making it to the finale of the season, which hadn't filmed at that point, but she was disqualified because of the allegations that she admitted to. Still, it was clear that she was going to be a central figure in the story for the season, given how much screen time she got in episode 2. The second episode that she was in, episode 3, was the first one that production took an axe to and edited her out of as much as possible. But she won this episode, and they ended up removing so much of her that it didn't make sense why she won. They also mostly removed her from the drama of the episode. Dave, please play clip 1.
3 girls, 1 brain. You all have to respond together the entire time.
That's so interesting.
That's a funny one.
Because the fact that we're supposed to be terrible, I don't feel like we have to actually be in sync. Like, Sherry starts to say something, and then I'm like,
and
kind of trying to follow along, you know what I mean?
I don't trust Aiden in leading a group.
Now, as I understand it, Sherry played a bigger role in the drama between Britta and Aiden of this season, with Sherry apparently agreeing with Britta that Aiden was a bad team leader. But we don't see that, and this doesn't even make sense based on what we are shown. Because what Aiden is saying here in this clip seems correct. In the challenge, production gave them the premise that they are 3 girls sharing 1 brain, but that they're faking it. So it seems like that she is correct in suggesting to be slightly off pace from each other when trying to say the words at the same time. So this drama makes no narrative sense, and we're probably missing a lot of important information that got cut out because Sherry was too involved in it. But this show does not get credit for what ended up on the cutting room floor, only what we saw on our TVs. That brings us to the challenge itself. All 4 groups are given characters that they have to play, improvising their way through an America's Got Talent-style show for talentless people called World's Worst. We go into it with Heidi and Closet as the underdog of this episode, with other queens earlier on saying that she's not a threat. Dave, clip 2, please.
Row, row, row your boat, gently down the stream. Now I'm going to take you to church this time. 5, 6, 7, 8. Roll, roll, roll your boat. Tip me down the creek.
Oh my God. Heidi's a breakout performer, and she seems ready to show everyone she should not have been placed in the bottom.
Woo! Oh, that was awful.
Shut up, Ross. Sorry. Force of habit. Heidi did great in this challenge. She had a good runway, and she had the narrative of proving the other girls wrong. And she probably should have won this episode, but she didn't. And we do not see how Sherry beat her. Also, as a side note, in this group, Gigi Good plays a character named Blanca Del Rio, who briefly dies. Is that a reference to past winner Bianca Del Rio's age? I don't know, because it is never addressed. The next group, the Squirrel Scouts, very quickly ignores the premise of the main challenge. But this is not the queen's fault. It's production's fault for giving them the premise. Instead of a talent, this quickly becomes a Shark Tank spoof for some reason, which would have made a good challenge itself as a branding challenge, but that's not what this was supposed to be. But still, Widow Von Du makes the most of it in clip 3.
We're here today to earn our reality television show merit badge. As you can see, we have so many already. I have this merit badge for having the best smile.
And I have this one because I can make matte lipstick out of berries.
And this is barbecue sauce.
She is great in this challenge, but she's not even in the top this week. She's confoundingly safe. Again, we do not see why Sherry beats her. And group 3 makes even less sense. Their group, they're gay, but they are secretly straight gay rights activists who dress up like fruits and tell knock-knock jokes. That's the best explanation that I have. Dave, clip 4, please.
I'm your fully real-lasting vegetable.
And we're gay.
We're super gay, and we're so excited to be representing our community here on this show. We just want everybody to know that you are all accepted, no matter who you are or where you are from.
You're a broccoli, but you're in the fruity, group.
Well, yes, she's a fierce Brock ally.
I'm a fierce Brock ally.
Dahlia Sin, the fierce Brock ally, goes home this week, but she keeps randomly appearing throughout the season as the fierce Brock ally. Nobody asked for it, but it just keeps happening. The final group is three girls, one brain. Sherry Pie wins this challenge. And at one point, Judge Michelle Visage says Sherry Pie was giving her Ethel Merman mixed with Lucille Ball. But this is the most that we really see from her in clip five.
Do you ever find this overwhelming in your daily lives, sharing one brain?
I can't do this anymore. I'm going back to James and the Peach.
That's it. That's pretty much all we see from Sherry Pie. Later, in a later episode this season, production does a better job at keeping in enough of Sherry Pie's performance in an acting challenge to justify her win without giving her extra screen time. But here, it's just a hatchet job. We're left scratching our heads about what happened to earn her the win. So I discussed the plot not making sense and the challenge itself being bad. The last component is the lip sync. Dahlia Sin and Nikki Doll are in the bottom and lip sync to Problem, which, to be fair, is Ariana Grande's best song if it's 2014. The performances are so lackluster and low energy. Both queens just keep strutting back and forth across the stage doing very little else. But I guess this moment is what gives Nikki the win in clip six.
Ziggy is. What you got? Small money, then I'll be better off without you. And no time I'll be forgetting all about you. Saying that you know, but I really, really doubt you. Understand my life is easy when I ain't around you. Iggy, Iggy, too biggie to be his cousin. I'm thinking.
Based on the reactions, did Nikki wow them with an outfit reveal or a well-timed split? Nope. She removed her fascinator and then did a squat. That's it. I thought it was going to be a double elimination, but Nikki is a fashion queen and the ball episode was the following week, so they kept her to turn some great looks. Probably. To recap, the storyline of the episode made no sense, the main challenge was poorly conceived and executed, and the lip sync was boring. All three of what I feel are the most important components of a Drag Race episode failed miserably, which is why I believe RuPaul's Drag Race Season 12, Episode 3, World's Worst, belongs in the Nonak.
Thank you so much for that presentation. Dave, please start us off.
Okay, I have a question about, like, drag out in the world when you perform drag, like, at a show. How much of it is, like, a solo effort and how much of it is group stuff?
I would say it's predominantly solo.
Yeah, okay, that was my impression.
Yeah, there are a lot of cases where people do group numbers or group sketches. It really depends.
Knowing that and throwing all the queens into an improv show is sort of a recipe for disaster. Because what I was thinking was not knowing all the backstory. So, like, here is my take on it without knowing the backstory of the scandal and then how they had to edit around it. Not knowing that at all, I was like, well, this episode seemed okay. Nothing special, nothing super terrible until the improv came into it. And then it totally fell apart for me because the improv itself, they just seemed extremely ill-equipped to deal with it. Like the three girls, one brain, took 2 years off my life, like 1 year of damage to my brain, and then 1 year spent watching it because it went on forever and it was one note and they just like didn't put a spin on it. And I just don't think it seems like improv is in the drag skill set as like a prerequisite.
Well, it's something that always comes up every season. And also, I think like at a show, you would see more crowd work, like a queen doing interacting with the crowd off the cuff.
Troop improv.
Right. Yes.
Right, is what I'm, and that's a different dynamic, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, crowd work's one thing. An improv show, like the way you would think of like ASCAT, you know, that kind of thing is a different animal. But then on top of that, sort of when you know what is going on in the editing, you have to wonder, like they probably had two choices. Minimize or villainize.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps they didn't have enough material for villainize, so they went with minimize, which, you know, that would be a call in the editing suite. Maybe they did the wrong call. Like, it seemed like it was so choppy at the end of all things that they, you know, cut off their nose to spite their face with this. And there's a lot of things I liked about this episode, like Heidi and closets was a delight. And I really wanted to see more from her. But then, like, I feel like she got lost in the editing mix because they had to sort of do these torturous edits and sort of color outside the lines a lot. So in short, not knowing, why did they do improv? These poor queens, they were ill-equipped to do it. Knowing is kind of an editing mess.
The last season of Below Deck, they had a similar problem.
Right.
And it became, I wasn't watching this season of RuPaul's Drag Race, which I'll sort of, that will be folded into my comments in a second. But Pete, this kid, Pete, turned out to be a complete pig. And they just were like, you know, Andy Cohen made some announcement that was like, well, we're just going to edit around him. And like, you literally did not ever see him again. Like, I think he was seen like leaving the boat at the end, but like he was still there. You just never saw him on the show. So I got the sense based on the opening Chiron that that's what we were in for with this episode. But what was interesting to me here is that a lot of my issues with this episode, while theoretically non-fatal, didn't necessarily proceed from the Sherry Pie post-production problem. Like, the challenge seemed poorly conceived and would have been that even if the eventual winner had been spotlighted more. And if we hadn't had like longer workroom exchanges instead, it felt like, and that sort of underlined another issue in like latter day Drag Race, in my opinion, which is that Rue has like this sort of Ouroboros Oprah self-image that is like some of the teasing is seeming a little self-important, not funny, not well-written, not getting Rue out of the way of the joke. Like it just is like it's not a good look. And, you know, I laughed a couple times, but this challenge, like, it just is not great. And this is part of why I don't really keep up with the show anymore, that there were these like sort of long beats that it's like, oh, this is, look how bad this is. This is awkward. Cut to Carson Kressley, like, bless his heart, but it's like he can't save this. That's not his job. So when I was watching this, I was very interested to hear the angle of the presentation from Santiago, because it's like, are these like pre-existing problems that I already had with the show that I was kind of like, I don't hate the show or anything. I just am all set. Or is this specific to this episode? And is it specific to the Sherry Pie issue? And it's sort of both. So I'm not sure where I'm going to come out on any of that. So I will kick it to Tara, but first I will observe that Miss Charo looks amazing. And this is someone who, not for nothing, had her age legally changed to make her 10 years younger. Like, she is a force of nature. I love her. That's all. So, I mean, this episode was not without its occasional pleasures, and she was one of them, and her little outfit and her legs, which are still great.
I have one more question before Tara goes that I forgot to ask. RuPaul challenging or criticizing Heidi N. Closet's name seemed a little rude to me. Would that be considered?
Thank you. This is exactly what I was talking about. Yeah. That was where I was like, why are you being a bitch? Like, this is not a good look, and it's not on brand for her workroom questions either. So,
I mean, it's a drag name, but it's a self-identifier. It seems like a very risky business to actually like go into it saying your name is bad. Like,
yeah.
It seemed.
Well, and also, how many fucking Heidi Hoes do there have to be worldwide? Hundreds, probably.
Yeah. And the other thing about it, not to get into like the power dynamics of everything, but it's like if RuPaul is in this position as like your name is bad, then as Heidi says, like RuPaul can call me whatever he wants as long as I stay in the competition. It's like, yeah, this is also what makes that bad. It's like
Exactly.
You know, he's holding all the cards, really.
True.
First, with regard to the Blanca Del Rio reference, there were, I think the reference for this act was the Del Rubio triplets, who were like, they were styled like that. They would sing, they would go on Pee Wee's Playhouse. This is before your time, I'm sure. But that was obviously the reference.
Very young and beautiful. Yes. For those listening.
Yes. So I think that's what, like, they just went Del Rio because there was a Del Rio in, like, the Drag Race family. So I don't think that was necessarily a slam. Dahlia, just to jump to the end, I watched all this season and I totally forgot Dahlia was even in it. I forgot about the runner with the broccoli as well. It's like, wow, she just had no personality at
that
all.
That lip sync was...
It was brutal. She just gave up. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, she bailed.
So yes, that, and to go back to the presentation on that point, yes, it was a bad lip sync all around. Like, nothing exciting happened. It was not memorable. She was obviously worse. And the fact that she just, like, stomped out at the end without giving a little sassy exit line is, like, she, like, there's
someone's
a question
not ready.
About how, yeah, how gracious you need to be in that circumstance. But still, it was like, this is not the way to leave. So maybe that was why they kept having her come back for walk-ons, to be, like, try and redeem her reputation so that if she's ever on an All-Star season, like, people don't get outraged, although I still would.
And then you saw her, like, hostage video at the end with at the lipstick mirror where she's like, yes, I stormed off, but I love RuPaul and thank you so much.
It's so, in terms of the challenge, to answer Dave's point, like, it is so early in the season for an improv challenge. Like, these people, they just met, some of them.
Yeah.
So it's like that they're really at a disadvantage. You know, if they didn't end up on a team with all people that were in their original group, what we haven't said is that it was a two-part premiere with, like, two groups of queens. So this is the first time all of them are together. And I think that puts some of them at more of a disadvantage than others. If they just, like, don't know each other and don't know each other's vibes, have never really interacted much, like, that's gonna put you on your back foot in an improv challenge like this. But on top of that, like... I mean, other than the Del Rio trio, all of them I thought were bad. The Scouts were bad. The Fruits were bad. Three Girls, One Brain is excruciating. So when it comes to the judging, so and the judges are all like, you were great. It's like, where? Like, that's not what I saw at all. Leaving aside the Sherry Pie of it all, it's just like, even when they were all together and it was supposed to be firing on all cylinders, like, not for me. You know, like, it's bad. And I mean, where they are in terms of humor, it's like when you get a hanging Chaz joke from Michelle in the year 2020, it's like, really?
Oh, Visage.
So, yeah, this was bad. And I, in terms of how they could have dealt with the Sherry Pie problem, like, I don't know if the answer was just to do a reply all podcast and be like, okay, we're just yanking the season. Like, obviously, VH1 is not in a position to do that. Maybe more thought should have gone into, like, can we, and just be like, we're going to jump right to the finale. Here it is. Sorry. I get for business reasons you can't, but yeah, it's rough. I mean, I think they got better as the season went on, but you're so right to call out this episode as a particular problem.
All right. Well, the one thing we didn't mention, guest judge. Blank canvas, Munn.
Olivia Munn. Christ, thank you for bringing that up. Because when Crystal has her breakdown on the runway and is like, I don't know how to present myself or whatever, and starts crying. And then Olivia Munn gives her a pep talk of like, here's what happened when I started in my career and look at me now. It's like, yeah, look at you. Like, who are you?
it's
coming from you is a little ridiculous.
Yeah. Could you speak up around Malini's? Okay.
All right, let's put this to the vote. Sarah D. Bunting.
I wasn't sure where I was going to come out on this, but the fact is it's bad and it doesn't really matter like which direction it's bad from. Yeah. It's like two-way bad. So, yeah, it's a yes from me for the no-neck.
Yeah, I agree. Bad on screen and probably some bad decisions behind the scenes too. Tara.
Yeah, me as well. No knack for sure.
Let the record show. I still love the show. Please don't kill me, RuPaul.
Also, it was a good presentation. Now I laugh hysterically.
Oh,
that means RuPaul's Drag Race Season 12, Episode 3, World's Worst. Guess what? You are inducted into the Extra Hot Great No-Neck.
Oh, God.
Turn it up, play it for your dogs.
Oh, yeah.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It's time to find out who our winner and loser of the week is. Sarah has this week's winner.
This week's winner is Dennis Quaid, who is joining Peacock's Joe Exotic, that's the Tiger King thing, as Rick Kirkham, who I've seen like all the auxiliary Tiger King crap. This is, from a voice standpoint, perfect casting. If Dennis Quaid was acting like he quit smoking, first of all, no, you didn't, and we all see you. And second of all, reverse course, because, yeah, perfect. I bet he already owns the correct hat also. So, yeah, that's really good casting. I don't know if this thing is going to be any good beyond the casting of it, but, yeah, that was very smart.
And loser of the week, Tara?
Well, when we talked about our aforementioned, when we had our summer TV preview episode, Dave brought up ABC's When Nature Calls, which was nature footage with funny commentary over it. And turns out they've cast a narrator, and that's going to be Helen Mirren. So, yes, TV's bottomless chum bucket has claimed Helen Mirren.
God damn it.
Well, speaking about bottomless chum buckets, do you know what time it is?
It's game time.
Game time.
Bottomless chum bucket is my Grindr profile name.
You broke Dave. All right. Well done.
All right. This is the ninth game time of the season. Season scores are Tara with 4. Once again, a win today will clinch the season for Tara. Nipping at Tara's heel are the value guests with 3 and Sarah with 1. Today we are playing Death Becomes Them from Potsy, who earns himself an extra credit. Topic. In today's game, I will read you a quick description of how a TV character died. You tell me the show. If you can answer correctly just from that piece of information, you get 3 points. If you don't know, you can pass this on to the next person in line.
Ooh.
Who can then answer for 2 points, but they get the character name who died as a hint. Now you're thinking, surely they can't pass it further. Well, you'd be wrong. You can continue to pass the question to the third person. They will get an additional hint that is one of the leads from the show.
Okay.
They, the last person, obviously cannot pass it. They must answer. Whoever answers, if you get it wrong, you lose those points.
Oh, my God.
So now you have a lot of strategy involved, whether you answer or pass.
Ooh. Okay.
Let's throw it to Picky to see who is going first.
We will start with Tara.
Tara, Sarah, Santiago, are we ready to play Death Becomes Them?
Yes.
Here we go. Starting with Tara. Stabbed in the neck with a quill for butchering Shakespeare. That is a method of death from a character, but from what show? You name the show.
Butchering Shakespeare. I'm going to guess it's that terrible show that Dan made us watch, Upstart Crow.
You just lost 3 points, starting the game with -3. That was Castle. Castle.
Okay.
Sarah D. Bunting. Crushed by a falling satellite.
Oh, gosh. Pass.
All right. That goes to Santiago. Crushed by a falling satellite. Name the show or pass it to Tar.
Dead Like Me.
Incorrect. That was Northern Exposure. Northern Rick. Exposure. So -2. -2. All right. Here is your full question, though. Poisoned after licking too many cheap envelopes. Name that show or pass it along.
I'm going to pass.
All right. passing, and that goes to Tara. Susan is your character.
Seinfeld.
Seinfeld, good for 2 points. Tara here for you.
Mm-hmm.
Pushed from roof, then stuffed into a mascot costume, possibly a beaver mascot.
Oh my God. Pass.
Passing to Sarah, who gets the information. Peter Coulter.
Peter Coulter. Pass.
All right, back to Santiago. Actor from the show is Dulé Hill.
Is this Psych?
Is it Psych? It is. Extra point there. Well done. Sarah D. Bunting.
Yeah.
Impaled on a metal pole following a train crash.
Pass.
Santiago. Bonnie Cranstoff. Sorry, let me do the
Grey's Anatomy.
Okay. Very good. Nice. 2 points. And here is your full question. Sawed in half by a mad magician. Name that series or pass it along.
American Horror Story Freak Show?
We'll take American Horror Story, but you are correct with the season as well. It was Freak Show. That was Maggie Esmeralda. Nicely done. That's our first 3 point.
Yep.
Nice.
Tara. Leaping into the lead. Yes.
Cooked inside an MRI machine.
Oh. Did this person actually die? I'm just going to guess. 911.
Mm. No. That person lived.
Right. Also, it was Lone Star.
That was X-Files. X-Files. Mm. Featuring history's greatest acting robot, David Duchovny.
Oh, of yes. course.
Sarah D. Bunting. Blown into bloody chunks trying to make safe some unstable dynamite.
I feel like I know this one, but I don't -3 points know it, so I'm going to pass.
All right, Santiago. Let's see here. Leslie Arst with a Z.
Arst.
Arst. Arst. Leslie Arst.
I'm also going to pass.
All right, we're passing it to Tara, who gets Terry O'Quinn. One of the leads. Not the person who died.
Right, right. Leads, that's sure. lost.
That is lost, correct. Good for one. Whew. All right. Dies of eclampsia thanks to her doctor's misdiagnosis. Name that show.
I think that's Grey's Anatomy.
Incorrect. We were looking for Downton Abbey. Downton Abbey, Lady Sybil.
Not what I would have guessed. Whoops.
Would have also been ER.
Yep.
And yeah, that's true. I guess that description could be quite a few things, probably, mm-hmm. in the history of films. Tara.
Yep.
Disassembled by his brother.
What the fuck? Pass.
Passing to Sarah. The person, the character that died is Lore. Lore.
Lore?
Yeah.
L-O-R-E.
Yeah, L-O-R-E, yeah. Pass or answer?
Hmm.
Hurry up.
Oh, the buzzer. Penny Dreadful.
Incorrect. That was Star Trek The Next Generation. That is Data.
Data's
disassembling
brother.
His
right.
brother. Sarah D. Bunting. Sprayed with poisoned perfume.
Poisoned perfume.
Mm-hmm.
Keeping with the alliteration. Pass.
Poison perfume pass to Santiago, who gets Madame de Man. Madame de Man.
I think this is Killing Eve.
It is Killing Eve. 2 points. Nicely done. And here is your full question. Committed suicide by drinking poisoned moonshine.
Pass.
That passes directly to Tara, who probably Justified. Knows it's Justified. That's Mags Bennett from Justified. Good for two. Tara.
Yes.
Head bitten off by a giant praying mantis.
Pass.
Passed to Sarah, Dr. Stephen Gregory.
Buffy.
Buffy the Vampire Slayer is correct. 2 points.
Nice.
Sarah D. Bunting, here is your full question. Back sliced open and organs splayed out in something called the Blood Eagle.
Oh.
I mean, if it's not this, I don't know what it is, and I need some actual points. So, Hannibal.
This bad way to die. Look it up. Yeah. All right, this will take us into our score break. Santiago, we've got Spine Ripped Out live on air. Spine Ripped Out live on air.
I had a nickel.
Yeah.
This must be a show.
Correct.
That's some pro stalling. Well done.
All right, answer or pass?
Pass.
All right, to Tara.
Mm-hmm.
Jerry McCafferty.
Fuck, I still don't know. Pass.
Pass to Sarah DeBunting. Anna Paquin.
Oh.
You must answer.
True Blood?
True Blood, good for one.
It'd be funny if you said Flack.
And that'll take us into the score break. We are a little more than halfway done.
Oh, boy. Santiago comfortably in the lead with 3 points. Sarah has
4.
I have -1.
Woo! This may be our first negative score at the end of game time. Boy, I hope so. All right, Tara.
Yeah.
Strangled when her scarf gets caught in the garbage disposal unit.
6 feet under?
Good guess. Incorrect.
Ought to.
Orphan Black. Orphan Black.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Oh,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Sarah, this is question 17.
Spread eagle. Feeling blood eagle.
Decent about your chances for a 3-pointer here. Run over by a Zamboni.
Run over by a Zamboni? I was like, did that happen on Bosch? Probably not. Pass.
All right. Santiago, you've got Eddie LeBec.
Fuck.
Is the character who got run over by a Zamboni. R.I.P. Eddie LeBec.
Yeah.
Answer or pass?
Pass.
All right, Tara, lead actor, Ted Danson.
Yeah, that's Cheers.
Cheers, correct.
Sure is.
All right.
Guess I don't have to watch that whole episode.
you missed on Eddie LeBec, but here is your full question. Suffocated inside a safe while trying to rob a fast food restaurant. Santiago.
Oh, The Good Place.
The Good Place. 3 points.
Damn.
Nicely done. And we know who that was.
Mendoza!
This is question 19 for Tara.
Yep.
Walled up alive in their Los Angeles apartment.
Is this 911? Fuck!
Incorrect. No. Sarah might know this one.
Bad Ronald?
No. That's Angel. Angel. That's Dennis
sure.
Pearson from Angel.
Sure.
Oh, right. Okay.
Sarah.
Yeah.
Drowned when his indestructible truck drove off a cliff. Probably.
I really
drowned when his indestructible truck drove off a cliff.
Chris from Melrose. Just kidding. I don't know, and I'm going to pass.
Passing. All right. Santiago, you've got Garth Knight.
Fuck.
All right. So you got two pieces of information here. You got Garth Knight and Sarah DeBunting.
Sarah's
going,
mad.
Fuck.
Is this Bosch? Just kidding. I'm going to pass. I don't know.
Passing over to Tara, who gets the lead actor, The Hoff.
Yeah, buddy.
Knight Rider.
Knight Rider, good for 1 point.
Oh, God. I forgot old Goliath went off a cliff.
All right. Santiago, bomb blows off half his face, but he still has time to straighten his tie.
Pass.
Passing. That passes to Tara, who gets
Breaking Bad.
Gus Fring in.
Yeah, buddy.
Breaking Bad. Correct. Tara.
Yep.
Drowned in a vat of premium chocolate.
Is this 911?
The commitment
incorrect.
Is...
The character was named Chad Ellis, but he's a nobody because that was CSI, an episode we recently watched.
Fuck! Yes, we did.
Original Ray's CSI Vegas version.
We sure did.
Sarah DeBunting.
Mm-hmm.
Shot by her robot double to allow the robots escape.
I guess I don't get to pass to myself. I don't remember hearing that. In the rules, pass.
Santiago, you've got Charlotte Hale is the character. So we got shot by a robot double to allow the robots to escape. Charlotte Hale, the victim.
That name sounds familiar, but I'm gonna pass.
Passing to Tara with the additional lead-ish actor, Jeffrey Wright.
Westworld.
Westworld, good for 1 point. Santiago, here's your full question. Head bashed in with a baseball bat wrapped in barbed wire. What a way to go.
Is this The Walking Dead?
Is it? It is. Yes. Correct. Full 3 Ooh, points.
Nice.
Everybody's last question about to happen. So let's get the scores here. Tara.
I would love to say it's anyone's game, but it definitely is not. I have -2. Sarah has
4.
Santiago's 9.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
Wow. All right. Tara.
Yep.
Here's your last question.
Mm-hmm.
Accidentally killed when a hero runs through her.
The Boys.
The Boys. And that.
So glad I'm finishing on this.
Oh, my God.
Puts you above
nice.
Water. Sarah D. Bunting. Threw herself into a cycle path, got knocked over onto the main road, and then run over. Threw herself into a cycle path, got knocked over onto the road, and run over. Answer or pass?
Sons of Anarchy.
Incorrect. Anybody want to take a crack at that for shits and giggles?
No.
That is the best friend who's already dead by the beginning of Fleabag. Boo.
Oh, oh yeah. Of course.
All right.
And I've ended in the
positive
zone, so
best dreams
came true.
Santiago, last question. Brain crushed with psychic powers.
That could also be The Boys.
There's no repeats.
No.
You can pass.
Just answer. You're yeah, one anyway.
Bosch.
Bosch. Is it Bosch? What if it was? That would be an interesting episode with them
sure
psychic powers. Alas, no.
Is that Heroes?
No, that there was a Heroes question originally in this game that was about brain sucking, but that's not the same.
Mm.
We are looking for Stranger Things. That's Connie from Stranger Things.
Oh, okay.
Oh, all right. Okay.
Final scores, please. Tara Ariano.
All right. Sarah D. Bunting finished with -2 points.
Oh, dear.
I had
fucking A.
A gentleman's 1, and Santiago is our winner with 6.
Wow. Nicely done, everybody. All right, I've got...
Oh, I thought I was going to lose to Tara.
Instead, you spanked me hard. Well done.
2 tiebreakers. We'll quickly play for future Steel Meals.
Okay.
Shout out the answer when you think you know it. I'll just piece out information as I see fit. First question is... Assassinated with an explosive scratch and sniff book. We're naming the show.
I want to say 24, but that seems unlikely.
It's not 24.
I want to watch whatever show this is.
It is not 911. The character is Anita Gray. And one of the leads of the show is Lee Pace.
Pushing daisies.
We're giving it to Santiago because you already had a guess.
Yep.
So value guess. Get that steam mail. All right, last one. Here we go. Fed to his father in a pie.
South Park?
that was chilly.
Game of Thrones.
Game of Thrones, correct. That was Lothar Frey from Game of Thrones. All right.
Yeah, chilly.
1 for Tara, 1 for value guess, but today belongs to...
Valued guest.
Ooh, next week is
I had so much fun. Thank you.
Woo! All right, guys, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We indulged our sweet tooth with Netflix's new deer-based survival drama before going around the dial with stops at We Are Lady Parts, Pose, Kevin Can Fuck Himself, and Mike Tyson, The Knockout. Oh, and Boy in the Plastic Bubble. We dramatized the behind-the-scenes goings-on at TV's newsy programs. And then Santiago didn't fuck it up when it came to getting World's Worst into the no-neck. We crowned winners and losers of the week. And yes, value guest Santiago wins this week's Game Time from Potsy.
Yeah.
Next up, it's Spin Spinoffs on Extra Extra Hot Great. And on the next EHG Prime, Loki. Remember.
We're listening. Ah.
Why, I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano.
I'm going back to James and the Peach.
Sarah D. Bunting.
What's it like out there?
And San Diego, Melly Huber.
I'm a fierce Brock ally.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great.
Happy Pride.
Even though I did storm off, I'm just thankful for the opportunity, to be honest. I'm thankful for the people that I got to meet. Then I went out in something cute, at least.